Richard Allen, known originally only as Negro Richard, was born in 1760 into a family enslaved by a prominent Philadelphia Quaker. As a late teen, he was deeply moved while hearing a Methodist preacher and became a devout Christian. Having purchased his freedom through hard labor, he became an itinerant preacher back in Philadelphia. He fostered a burgeoning black membership in St. George's Church until that congregation's elders changed long-standing policy and relegated blacks to the Negro pews up in the gallery. Richard Allen withdrew and, along with 11 other African-American Methodists, purchased a former blacksmith shop, moved it to 6th and Lombard Streets, where on April 9, 1799, he led the inaugural service for the Mother Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church. Patrick Calhoun was born in Ireland in 1727. He immigrated to the American colonies, settling in the Abbeville district in upstate South Carolina, marrying Mary Caldwell, a daughter of Scottish immigrants, becoming the father of three children, and attaining status as a wealthy landowner, prominent politician, and one of the largest enslavers in the upstate. In 1782, Mary Caldwell and Patrick Calhoun would welcome a fourth child to their family, John Caldwell Calhoun. Richard Allen's congregation in Philadelphia soon grew to more than 450 members. The blacksmith shop became a respectable brick sanctuary. Additional congregations were established in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Cincinnati, Chicago, Detroit. Allen's African Methodist Episcopal Church, AME, became the first independent black denomination in the U.S. John C. Calhoun, the product of a backcountry education, entered Yale in 1802, graduating Phi Beta Kappa 2 years later. He read law, apprenticed with a Charleston lawyer, married into a wealthy family, and was elected first to the South Carolina legislature and then to the United States House. He served as Secretary of War, held 2 terms as Vice President, and was a United States Senator until his death in 1850. Calhoun was at the center of the issues that were dividing the nation. As a Southern slaveholder, he became one of the staunchest defenders of a state's rights position, finally threatening that if the North would not compromise on the issue of slavery, then, quote, let the states we both represent agree to separate and part in peace, end quote. In 1816, black members of a Charleston, South Carolina Methodist church withdrew over a dispute. Under the leadership of Reverend Morris Brown, they organized a new congregation of persons of color and affiliated it with Richard Allen's church in Philadelphia. It became the first AME congregation in the South, in the city where Calhoun had practiced law and would later be buried. Among Calhoun's writings is an 1837 impassioned defense of slavery. In it, he dismisses those who consider slavery evil and names it instead a good, a positive good. When the first Unitarian congregation in Washington, D.C. was formally organized in 1821, among the 17 individuals listed as founders was the then Secretary of War, John C. Calhoun. A later minister, Moncure Conway, would report, Calhoun gave a large subscription. And a gentleman who received it told me that in giving it, the senator said, it will be the religion of the country in 50 years. The majority of the early First Unitarian congregation, later our All Souls congregation, where I spoke last winter, the majority of the early First Unitarian congregation sympathized with the Southern attitude to slavery. The new AME congregation in Charleston was harassed by white leaders. Members were arrested, some were beaten. Then in 1822, the Young Church was investigated for its involvement with a planned slave revolt organized by Denmark Vesey, one of the congregation's founders. Their beloved church was burned by angry whites. Undeterred, the congregation continued to worship after the church was rebuilt. In 1834, all black congregations in Charleston were outlawed. The congregation still prevailed, worshiping underground. Then finally, in 1865, it was formally reorganized and adopted the name Emmanuel, meaning God with us. One of the major streets now bisecting Charleston is Calhoun Street. A spacious park on that street features an 80-foot pedestal topped by the figure of Senator, Vice President, Enslaver, Unitarian, John C. Calhoun. Just two blocks away stands the church, founded by Reverend Morris Brown, attended by Denmark Vesey, burned by angry whites, reconstituted by free blacks, Mother Emmanuel, African Methodist Episcopal Church. It's the church where a young white terrorist stood up in a Bible study and slaughtered 9 members. 3 weeks ago today, I climbed the steep steps in front of Mother Emmanuel AME Church on Calhoun Street in Charleston, South Carolina. I saw hanging on the wall in their vestibule a framed picture. It was Richard Allen. I ascended the interior stairway and took a seat in the balcony of that beautiful sanctuary. For the next more than 3 hours, I worshiped with members of that congregation alongside many visitors. I watched young black men robed as acolytes ceremoniously light altar candles and leaned over the railing to view elegant gloved ushers and a robed choir process. I heard a long and stirring prayer by a woman who was in that Bible study on that fateful night and was one of 3 to survive the massacre. We sang gospel hymns I knew from my youth. The choir sang with soaring emotion, accompanied by a trumpet, drums, and a grand pipe organ. How great is our God! How great is our God! Sing with me, sing with me. How great is our God! There in that elegant stained glass windowed room, one floor above where the massacre had occurred just days earlier, they later sang over and over, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Whom shall I fear?" I was deeply moved by their spirit, by their gratitude, by their bold and unbroken faith. They stood tall that morning on the shoulders of faith-filled forebears who had themselves come treading a path through the blood of the slaughtered and who did not turn back and did not give up. Here, in part, is why I share all of this. Every single time we hear speak in any way about Christianity, about those who've placed their faith in God, about those who hold to and are guided by a faith that may defy our understanding, I want us now and from now on to remember that includes the faithful saints of the Mother Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. My faith is different. My religious worldview is different. My understanding of what is possible is different. But my professed faith, the faith that I profess, means I cannot speak with anything but immense respect for what I experienced there that day. So have I told you all of this to point up how Christianity, as exemplified by Mother Emmanuel, is so much more admirable than Unitarianism, as exemplified by John C. Calhoun? Hardly. That comparison would be absurd. Right? Thomas Wentworth Higginson was a Unitarian minister who, unlike Calhoun and the majority of the D.C. Unitarians, was an unmistakable abolitionist. After the war, Higginson wrote a piece he called Sympathy of Religions. When comparing religions, he urged, test each sect by its best or its worst, if you will, by its high watermark of virtue or its low watermark of vice. But falsehood begins when you measure the ebb of any other religion against the flood tide of your own. There is a noble and base side to every history. Higginson insisted, we have no right to pluck the best fruit from one tree, the worst from another, and then say that the tree is known by its fruits. But that is, in fact, what some of us do. Wring our hands with such consternation at the absurdities of religion. Point up the worst things that we can find and declare them to be the most obvious examples. Here's how that could work. We could highlight a prominent 19th century minister whose family was enslavers and who declared, I believe that the enemies of slavery have exaggerated the bodily pain inflicted by the master on the slave. His name? William Ellery Channing, one of the founders of Unitarianism. Or the prominent 19th century minister who declared, the African race is greatly inferior to the Caucasian. His name? Theodore Parker, who we acclaim as one of our greatest
and even tout his role as an abolitionist. Let us admit it today. Our religion originated with people of immense privilege, immense white privilege. Often throughout our history and to this current day, we have usually been the beneficiaries and thus often the defenders of the status quo. To suggest otherwise is to engage in a rewrite of heritage, the likes of which we are seeing a bit too much these days already. I'm not here today to bash our liberating religion. I am here to say that one of the ways we can be a healing force is by discontinuing our simplistic judgment of other people of faith. We can help overcome the barrier of religion by heeding the counsel of our own religious forebear who urged us to compare the best of who we are with the best of who others are, or the places of our greatest hypocrisy with the times they belied their faith. Put simply, I'd love to think that if a member of Mother Emmanuel were to visit here, she might feel as welcomed as I was made to feel. Which means not hearing her beloved religion mocked, the language of her faith derided, her sacred scripture scorned. Alice Walker, in words we heard earlier, affirms, "You are tied to no particular temple, wall, or rock." Then she adds, "Believing this as I do, there's no resistance to the idea that what is foreign can be known, can be understood, can be held in an embrace of love that is, in fact, the same love that holds the universe. You are tied to no particular temple. Therein lies the way to another bridge. I believe in our liberating religion. I believe it has important good news. But when I am in the larger community, I don't need to wear it on my sleeve or, quite honestly, on my back. I'm not talking about donning a t-shirt for a pride parade, but I am talking about the need to dot Selma with yellow shirts and then talk with pride that there were more of us there than any other religious group. When I'm participating alongside others, I find more value in seeking and exemplifying a common good than I do in offering a sectarian account or picture of who we are. Here, perhaps, is what is behind that inclination. For too long, we've thought of ourselves as apart from many, maybe even most other religious people. We've spoken of this place as an escape, somewhere where we can get away from them. We've smirked, we've called ourselves those recovering, we say, from other religions. We've engaged in comparisons with other traditions in which we almost always sound more truthful, more exemplary, and certainly less hypocritical by far. As we move forward in envisioning our future, I'd love to see us begin to think of ourselves not as apart from other traditions, but as a part of the increasingly colorful religious tapestry in our region. I'd love to see us less tied to this temple and more engaged in building bridges, less inclined to wait for them to show up here and more open to showing up in places unfamiliar to so many of us, less committed to sectarianism of any kind, including our own, and more given to seeking some common good. Less apt to easy stereotyping and more interested in finding common ground. Three days after attending the service in Charleston, I drove to Columbia, the state capital, where I sat through over 12 hours of deliberations about removing the Confederate battle flag from the State House grounds. During one of the recesses, I retreated with our young daughter out into the sweltering heat of the Columbia evening. Making my way to the sidewalk, I saw a man, 40-something, clad in shorts and a bright red T-shirt, waving a Confederate flag. I walked up to him, and I asked, "What brings you out here?" He smiled. He told me he was a part of the Sons of the Confederacy, and he was dismayed that so few of his fellows were participating. "How about you?" he said. "Why are you here?" "Well, I'm not entirely sure." "What do you do?" "I'm a minister." "Really? Can I tell you about my church?" Sure. I said with some hesitation, Annie listening in. Stuart proceeded to tell me that he left his Southern Baptist church disgruntled. He found a church he loves. Part of what he loves is that everyone is welcomed there. They have people of all races. It's very diverse. And everyone gets along. He told me how they hosted a big dinner to which they invited a dozen or so congregations, all of them African American. Most of them came, he said. "We sang, we listened to each other, we ate. Then," he said with a big smile, "we danced." "I deplore the flag," he waved. "I deplore it. There is no one who has a more Southern heritage than I do. I don't need anyone to explain to me what that flag has meant. I held my breath when I walked up to him, especially knowing that my young daughter was going to hear whatever he had to say. And I labor under no illusion whatsoever that we see the world in anything like the same way. But there, for an absolutely incongruous moment, a liberal minister and a Confederate flag waver were sharing a story, trying somehow to build a bridge. I turned to go back into the chambers for a wearying night. "Nice to meet you, Stuart," I said, shaking his hand. "Take care of yourself." Later, in the wee hours of the next morning, as we celebrated the House vote there in the chambers, I reached out my hand again. This time to a native son of my own hometown, there also to witness this historic occasion. A civil rights hero. Fierce. Flawed. Faith-filled. Who had helped lead that effort behind the scenes. Congratulations. Congratulations, I said to Jesse Jackson. And thank you. What a world. What a world. For all God's children.